Good afternoon, good evening, good day to you, wherever you are. This is the Technology Whisperers with Sean Muller, and I'm Alistair Ross. And today we're joined with Bernard Hickey, independent speaker and writer about economics and politics. He's also the producer of the podcast The Caca and Five in Five with ANZ. He's also the host of the spin-offs When the Facts Change podcast. Bernard, good day to you.
Hi, how's it going?
Yeah, fantastic.
Have you ever had that good an introduction with that Scottish accent?
Yeah. No, that's great. It's always nice to hear a different flavor.
Oh, I mean, I'm still Kiwi as, bro. I mean, I've been here for almost 15 years, something like that anyway. Yeah, it's been a while, a Kiwi, so I'm used to speaking. I mean, this is me. My voice somehow never changed, but everything else, I mean, my words are sweet as, I think. My accent, I guess I'm never going to lose it. Yeah.
It's not that thick an accent. Well, they're much thicker
you.
Gaelic accents.
Gaelic. Scotch and Gaelic. Goodness me. Yeah. So Bernard, like I've given you a little bit of an intro there, but why don't you tell us a bit about yourself? What's life and what like being with Bernard?
Yeah. No, I'm very lucky. I get to think about and talk about and discover every day the thing that I've always been fascinated and passionate about, which is how economies work and how politics works and how those two things smash together, meld, merge into the political economy and come up with why it is our tax rates are where they are, why it is our society has certain wage rates and interest rates and house prices and why it is some people get elected and some don't, and all of those things. It are constantly fascinating to me. It's like a combination of mathematics and social sciences, or the weird accidents of history that mean all sorts of things are never quite right, but we're always trying to make them better.
Yeah, absolutely.
And there's a lot of data there, right? I mean, when you look at the economics and the political, obviously we've been doing politics for quite a while. And, you know, with Cambridge Analytical, we saw a massive move towards data-driven political in the United States and the UK in the last 5 years. Are you seeing be more analytical driven across even New Zealand and across the rest of the world?
Yeah, I've been fascinated by how the likes of Brad Parscale, you might know of, a guy who went from essentially being a social media analyst and operator to being Donald Trump's right-hand man running his online campaigns. And when you look at how Cambridge Analytica and the Trump campaigns effectively use tools that hadn't been used before to hyper-target, it looked pretty both scary and fascinating. There has been more use of that here in Aotearoa in the last couple of elections. I sense this election not quite as much as the last one, because a bunch of people have sort of drifted away from some social media, and some social media too have drifted away from news.
Yeah.
Facebook in particular has basically turned its algorithmic fire hose away from news to something else. And yeah. Twitter, or the artist formerly known as Twitter, has become frankly unusable and painful, yes, from a news point of view. So I suspect there has been a fracturing and a dilution of the, yeah, power of some of that social media in a political sense. But, you know, still a lot of money has been spent on, you know, Facebook and Instagram and those types of ways of getting messages across.
Do we even still see the investment? I mean, you know, we go back 20 years, right? The massive investment in advertising was done on TV. Do we still, I mean, is that gone by the wayside? I mean, I don't even watch TV. I only watch streaming services now, because it's not even something that occurs to me. But I do know that there's still a majority of people in this country and in the US and in Europe that watch TV. Actual broadcast television. My children have no idea what a commercial is. First time my 8-year-old son saw that, he was like, why are they talking about cereal in the middle of my show? So did we see within the last 5-6 years that shift to social media spending from political campaigns?
Yeah, like a lot of advertising, the move from traditional media, television, newspapers, radio has happened also in politics. More so in the United States, I think, than in other places, in part because the numbers are so much larger. In the United States, there are entire media sectors that effectively rely on political advertising for a lot of their money. You know, yeah. Fox News and a lot of those cable news networks really could not exist in their form without the billions of dollars in TV advertising that goes to them. And there is a whole subculture of fixers and distributors and people who take a cut of the money that gets distributed, because it's not nearly as easy as it used to be to dump a lot of money and reach a lot of people with a single buy. There's an awful lot of slicing and dicing and targeting and all sorts of funny business that goes on, to the point where, you know, you can be a political consultant, a political advertising consultant in the United States, and, you know, you actually have to talk to a human or get a vote. You spend all your time charging a percentage choice on hundreds of millions of dollars being distributed to your connections or the people that you think are going to reach certain people. You know, one of the most interesting developments in US media, I think, over the last couple of decades has been the Supreme Court's rulings, which effectively created an enormous volume of money for ads to push around political opinion in the United States, independent of the political process. We don't have that yet to the same extent. And a lot of the television advertising in particular is regulated and doesn't involve huge amounts of money. It's relatively cheap to get your 10 cents worth into the New Zealand political environment and get access to people, much cheaper than you'd think in other places. You can get a vote in New Zealand for a few bucks. You know, there are people in the United States who spend hundreds of dollars per month on advertising. Yeah.
So just bringing it round now to Aotearoa, New Zealand, obviously this week is a very big week, or it was a very big week, even bigger last week. We're recording this on the 18th of October, so this will be out in a couple of weeks after that, Bernard. But obviously we had the election, and we still don't know quite how the future government's going to shake out, but we do know an awful lot about what it's going to look like. Sean, do you have a question about where we're at the moment with the government and what the potential future is going to be with?
Yeah, thanks. Thanks, Alistair. I appreciate you bringing us back, because that's what I was about to do as well. So, Bernard, obviously with the shift in government from Labor to National is what it looks like it's going to go out to. And the fact that we have seen across the ministries massive amount of underinvestment, what we call technology debt. Obviously, Alistair and I have a technology bent. Both of us have 20 plus years, almost 30 years experience in technology. And we've seen how much businesses and public institutions struggle when they don't invest in the technology the way they're supposed to. What we're hearing from National is that seems to be a focus, especially in New Zealand. So what does that mean for us? I mean, from your perspective and your wider view within the political and, more importantly, the economic spectrum of what we're talking about, obviously we only have so much money that the government has to spend shifting. And is it going to be good for the tech? I mean, the tech industry is the second highest GDP in New Zealand. So
yeah, you'd have to hope that whoever's in power is going to use those tools to improves the level of service and the efficiency of spending by the government. But there is a skepticism and a caution about big projects. And that's partly because some of the big projects, particularly around transport infrastructure, have been incredibly painful in recent years in terms of getting things out the door, you know, making sure that there's something for people to drive on. But also this, no doubt, as there are in the private sector, you know, horror stories of budgets that have been blown out, timeframes that have been blown out, and a risk aversion. There's a particular risk aversion in the public sector or big tech projects, because it's so easy to make these things public. You know, quite interesting, when you deal with anyone in the public sector, one of the first questions they ask is, so is this OIA-able?
Yeah.
And you know, how am I going to ensure that my minister doesn't get embarrassed by this?
Yeah.
Which does seem to kill the vibe about, you know, being ambitious and being interested in, you know, really getting the job done fast. There's certainly not the same agility and ambition in the public sector use of tech that there is in particularly anything to do with startups or the private sector, although I'm sure there's some very large private corporations who are just as there.
Oh, yeah. So, especially the banks.
So let's put that. The MB says that 97% of New Zealand's business is SME, right? So we're less than 20 staff. So perhaps there's a way then that we could focus on small to medium business rather than large or big projects. The big projects, just like you say there, Bernard, you know, those are the things which are, you know, if they go over budget, if they go long, then those are the things that really are bad PR. So what about catalyst style, startup style, you know, small burner projects, the things that, you know, could still get some headlines for the government and it would still be seen very visibly by a large part of the country. What about that?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting question about what is the role of government in improving productivity and the use of technology. One of the areas you can do it is by investing in underlying infrastructure. And it's interesting, the National Party, which obviously is about to be running the government, one of its most successful interventions in the public sector was the ultra-fast broadband project under John Key and Bill English and Stephen Joyce, which was unusual at the time in using public money to essentially invest in a privately or at least semi-privately owned infrastructure, and in combination with some regulatory interventions, provided a backbone of bandwidth that really has helped the nation in various ways. It has made it easier to work remotely from smaller provincial towns if they've got decent fiber. It has put us several years, maybe a decade or so ahead of Australia, for example, who botched their broadband rollout. And if you look at the history of, you know, government intervention and spending public money on private infrastructure in a way that's productive and creates the benefits of, you know, 1 + 1 = 3 in terms of spending money, then that's been really effective. And it's been effective for small and large businesses simply because of the benefits of underlying infrastructure. Whether you can do that, something like that again, in a way that helps small businesses, I don't see an obvious way. One interesting point is around the growth of the data center industry and the way that the previous government now, Labor, was quite keen on doing these deals, if you like, with some of the big tech companies on getting some of these data centers into the country. That's important. The other thing that's relevant here is the role of the government in regulating for the electricity industry. Forget that these data centers are as much about access to electricity as anything else, and particularly renewable electricity. So there's a potential superpower that New Zealand could use there, not just to, you know, turn all that water into power for data centers instead of aluminium, but also to, you know, promote New Zealand as a place for green data centers, and also, you know, get some control and have some access to renewably powered data centers for our own businesses and government too, because that's the danger here. We, particularly in the move to AI, where the energy use is enormous compared to, you know, the basic stuff, and that's an opportunity and a threat for us. One of the major problems, though, I think, underpinning this, and I don't think it's going to be solved by this government, is that all the incentives in our economy are designed to essentially not bother to invest in technology in your business, because that's not where the money can be made. In New Zealand, we have a massive tax advantage for leveraged investment in residential land. And when you have some spare cash, either as a business or a household, the obvious thing to do is to put it into some dirt and wait. That's what you need to do. You don't have to invest in a business. You don't have to employ people. You don't have to change technology. And if you do have a business that's generating cash, it makes no sense to make that more efficient. Just employ more workers. They may be on a wage that isn't particularly high. They're not being very productive. But the returns on your investment from leveraged residential land, risk adjusted, are way higher than, you know, taking a risk on building a business or, you know, implementing a technology or arranging a merger and acquisition that would generate the sort of productivity growth that you see all over the world in all sorts of different ways.
Do you see New Zealand ever getting into a situation where that will change in the next sort of 15, 25 years?
I wish, but no. I've been covering this now for 30 years. And way back in 2005, 6, I thought that house prices were way out of whack, that our tax system was so obviously screwed up that some grown-up would intervene and solve the problem, or a collection of grown-ups.
Yeah.
Instead, what we've had is at least a collection where the simple question of should we tax capital gains on residential land price appreciation has been considered, rejected. Our politicians have run scared. Other politicians have beaten their head against brick walls. Careers have ended. You know, we've just had arguably the most successful and popular politician in our lifetimes who said, I can do anything, but that's not something I could ever do. Which is, you know, bring in a capital gains tax. And then her successor, who was 45, said that he couldn't fix it in his political lifetime. And just in recent days, he said he's going to continue on. So unfortunately, we've created a situation where the people who you need to get to vote for you, what we call the median voters, they are completely addicted, captured, and focused on protecting those leveraged capital gains on residential investment. And more importantly, ensuring that their children get access to future gains on residential investment. There's also a fear element here in that a lot of families understand now that the costs are so high to get a deposit and to buy your own home that you will inevitably need help from parents or family. Yeah. And so that means if you're not in property, you need to get there real fast. Otherwise, you'll miss out on the next doubling, tripling of prices in the next 5-10 years. And certainly the election results, in my view, has unleashed another 20% rise in house prices in a matter of days because of the reversion back to the situation for rental property investors. And also what I suspect will be at least 2 or 3 years of roads and public infrastructure investment scene, where the new government, in a desperation to cut spending and to control big projects, will simply stop big projects. So ones that were on the brink of happening are not going to happen. Conical Order, for example, one of the biggest investors in new homes and other infrastructure and planning, will go into a massive freeze. And so what you're going to see is another wave higher in prices and an even higher incentive for those people who now depend on those leveraged loans, not just for themselves, but for their family, to make sure that we have the next wave of growth and that their kids get access to that next wave of life. And yeah, I wish that a bunch of people would vote against their own financial interests, but the scale of those interests are now so high. We're talking $1 trillion, the value of New Zealand's residential land. It is worth nearly 10 times the value of our stock market. So in the United States, for example, the stock market is worth the same, one times the same as the housing market. It's so out of whack here. It's almost like it's too big to fail. It's too big to change. And for a whole generation, the ones whose parents don't own property, their only hope really is to get the hell out of New Zealand and start a life somewhere else.
Mm. Yeah, I was actually about to ask that. I mean, not only are we seeing an exodus of tech businesses and also highly skilled individuals But now we're also you're also saying, Bernard, there that we're going to be seeing a generation of people, just you know, Joe Public, leaving the country because they can't afford to buy housing. So all of this here is collecting a narrative on the fact that we have to fit. It's not like we, you know, I understand the politicians' reticence to do this because it's going to make them very unpopular. But if we don't fix this very quickly, then we're going to be in a situation where the country is just going to nothing.
So if we look at like a comparison to Ireland, right? So that's, everybody makes the comparison between New Zealand and Ireland because physically the same, roughly the same sized countries, population is close-ish between the two. You see what Ireland has done, you know, policies that they've put in place at the government level, the investments in R&D, the decisions that they're going to become a tech economy and they're going to invest in that. Is that the kind of policies and strategies that the New Zealand government needs to be looking at and the planning that the New Zealand government needs to be looking at?
Yeah, that would be great. Ireland has a couple of natural advantages that we can't take advantage of. For example, you know, it's right next to the massive European Union market and has a special entry into it. And also it's right next to the dumbest country in the world, which is the United Kingdom, which chose to exit from that big market. And Ireland said, "Arr, good on you. We'll have that. Thank you very much." And so every English language speaking global corporate in the world went, "What the? I'm off to Ireland." And so that helped. And the other thing is, of course, the Irish have been pretty clever and ruthless and selfish, you could argue, in essentially playing a game to grab these big tech and pharmaceutical companies and provide a big tax break for them.
Yeah, the tax advantage to the multinationals is massive. So what's the long-term out? The reality, by the way, the U.S. does the same thing. The U.S., if you came in and said, "I need to fix Social Security," we'd never get elected. If you came in and said, you know, "We need to set up a national sales tax," or "We need to reform income tax in the U.S., that's the end of your electoral career. You're not going to get elected. The reality is, and there have been many, many, many people that have talked about this, voters will always vote themselves cakes and circuses, even as the government and the rest of the country is burning.
Look.
But what's the long-term perspective for New Zealand? I mean, where does it go? Because there is a finite amount of external investment from wealthy Chinese people buying land in New Zealand. Eventually, there's no more money flowing into New Zealand. Where do we go? I mean, so is it a 10-year horizon? Is it a 25-year horizon? What does it look like?
It's at least a 70-year horizon because there is about 100 million people who are very rich or will be very rich in North and South Asia. So China, India, Indonesia, Malaysia, Philippines, who, because of climate change, will need to go to somewhere that's not burning or drowning. And even though we've got our own burning and drowning problems, they're not as bad as in Bombay or Delhi or Shanghai or Beijing. And those 100 million people, they're not the poor ones. They're the rich ones who want to put their kids into a university or a school and have two or three bowl holes and places to go when the proverbial hits the fan or the fan gets drowned or the fan goes up in flames. And New Zealand is a fantastic place, you know, stability. We've got water. We've got English language, functional financial system. All of the
sustainable electricity, sustainable power.
Exactly.
Look, it is a negative story, but look, that this is the technology whisperer. So what we try and do is we try and demystify this. And the reality is that you're honestly laying the challenges around the policy and the economic impact and the economic reality of why we see this massive amount of underinvestment in technology. If I was a small, medium, or even a large business, and I had a choice between, you know, buying another piece of land, even just to bank it for the moment, or replacing the massive monolithic database application that I have on premise, okay, it's burned. I can live with it for a little bit longer. That's a better investment, even the long-term strategy for my business. If I want to grow to a place where I can go multinational, it's still better. You know, even if I buy this property over here and I sit on it, let this burning technology platform go a little bit longer, If I sit on it for 5 years, then upgrade the tech, I've still come out ahead.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, there is a lot of people who, just for their own personal pride, want to run a good business and to have a growing business. You know, no one really wants this situation. You know, they want to do honest, good work, and they want to grow, and they want to prove that they're just as talented and growth oriented as the rest. And of course, a lot of people have either grown up or worked or seen how real economies and real businesses work. They've seen the United States, they've seen Australia, they've seen the UK. And that, by the way, these are all places with capital gains taxes. And and they understand what a really high growth business can do. It can create an enormous amount of value for those people who create it and for the shareholders and the pension funds and all of that stuff. I mean, we're living in a golden age in many ways, in that an awful lot of people have become rich because of investments in technology and in the creation of businesses and intellectual property, which has created an enormous amount of wealth and good and GDP and services and all sorts of things for all sorts of people. And they've participated in that wealth generation. But they're in places where, for example, let's say Australia, that's the closest example. But in Australia, if you are a saver, a household, you get a tax break for putting money into a pension fund. It's compulsory, and that the Australian pension fund is now worth $3 trillion. It is the fifth biggest pension fund in the world, or an economy which is the 44th biggest economy in the world. The Australians have invested heavily. Now, a lot of it's been into mines and holes in the ground. But also, you know, they invest in their businesses and their infrastructure and technology. I mean, there are amazing companies that have come out of Australia, you know, Canberra, Atlassian, you know, there's a whole bunch of them. Sure, we've got one or two, zero. It's really interesting. We talk to the CEOs and the founders of some of these companies. I talked to Rob Fife, you know, he's a talented marketer and manager and runner of businesses and grower of businesses. He was the executive chair of Icebreaker, and you know, these are talented business people. These are serious people who can compete with others in internationally competitive businesses. You know, Icebreaker competes with Nike, and you know, Zero competes with Intuit and all of that. These are serious, successful businesses. Talk to them. How does they get wealthy? Well, they just own land. Seriously. CEOs of very large, very successful CEOs of very large businesses will quietly tell you that they actually made most of their personal money from owning two or three properties or a bit of land on an island somewhere. And when you ask them, so was it all worth it? And they say, well, you know, for my personal pride, I wanted to, you know, be a CEO and I wanted to do all this stuff. But actually, it was hard work. I had to travel a lot. You know, I didn't see my family as much as I'd like. I should have just retired at 38. Bought a BMW, had the batch, got the boat, it'd be fine.
So, Bernard, the last question I'll ask is, why are you not in Australia now then? What's keeping you here? Are you got lots of land over here?
Yes, I'm building up a very large rental property portfolio. No, the guts of it is I've got two daughters who live here and are going through university, and it's a matter of time before they go to Australia. And then as soon as they have children, I'm off. I mean, that's the guts of it. The other option is to just, you know, leverage up the land that I was lucky enough to have simply because when I was born, I'm 57. Yeah. So that means I could buy a house in 1991 for $110,000 for three times income. That's not possible anymore. And in theory, what I should be doing is leveraging the hell out of that so that I can help my own daughters get deposits so that they can attract partners.
I really appreciate you coming on, Bernard. It's not a good news story, but it's a story that we need to understand, and we need to be able to get our heads wrapped around it, especially, you know, that we just had an election. Another 3 years are going to go through this, and then we're going to go through the election cycle. But I really appreciate you having you on, and you taking the time to talk with us.
That's right. It's lovely to talk to people who are actually really focused on building successful businesses and using technology. I'm a huge fan of our technology development. I've built online businesses and they've been successful. And I wish everyone the same. And I'm a huge, you know, admirer and of many of the growth businesses in New Zealand. It's almost despite all of this that we have an IT industry, which is now the second or the third biggest export earner, apart from, you know, simply an employer and a runner of it's here. And, you know, a lot of the real value that's created has come out of that stuff. And it's sort of amazing, actually, that we've done any of it. And mainly it's because people haven't done the maths properly and realized that they should have just parked it. But almost for their own personal pride, they've decided, okay, well, I should do something with this and create something. Good on them. I'm a huge fan.
Alistair, do you want to wrap us up?
Oh, yeah. No, look, as I say, again, it's great to have you on the show. And, you know, not all of our stories can be shiny, shiny unicorn stuff. So I really appreciate having this different sort of view on our economy. And I think, you know, if anybody wants to change these things, then education is where it's at. Now, you know, it's a ship that will turn very slowly, but having people like you on podcasts and other things like that allows this level of education to come out and actually help people understand what they need to do in order to change the ship if that's what they want to do. So yep. I really do appreciate you taking the time to tell us all about the state of the economy, tell us what the political outlook looks like right now and what it's like for our listeners in technology. So thank you again, Bernard. It's been great having you on the podcast. All the best.